Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis, and I'm joined today by our senior consultant, Lauren Williams. How's it going, Lauren?
I am having a great day, Trav. How's your day going?
It's pretty good. I mean, baby's sleeping through the night. I'm getting more sleep. I'm really tired still, but at least we're kind of over that initial hump that you just constantly wake up in the middle of the night. That happens sometimes, but thankfully, baby's doing a little bit better.
Do you have like a secret weapon that worked? I know there's so many different ways they say to get the baby to sleep through the night.
So we've got this sound machine going on, and then we also have this, It's a Small World drilled into my brain, because we've got this little planet thing that goes around. It plays like the Small World tune 50% of the time, I feel like. So those two things we have combined, like pretty much knock her out every time. And I kind of feel like that's unnecessary. My wife's like, no, we got to make sure that we do the same routine. And I mean, I can't really complain if it keeps baby asleep, because we've got baby in our room with us, and we've got my in-laws in another room, and we live all five of us in a 1,000-square-foot apartment. So this pandemic's been fun for me.
Wow, way to keep it interesting.
Yeah, you know, we're moving, and I think a lot of people know that, the email list people know that, and we're going to North Carolina. Definitely first thing on my list is like an 8,000-square-foot house. I think I'm just so like, traumatized from like pandemic living and like being in a small place. Like, we kind of rented this apartment thinking like, oh, this is great for like the two of us. And then we had like a baby, and then we needed childcare, and it was a pandemic. And so my wife's parents came to help, and oh my gosh, it's been a stressful year.
Well, I think you might be increasing your home size. I don't imagine you as an 8,000 square foot house kind of guy.
No. At this point, any improvement will be great. Did I tell you too, a tree fell in our car the other day? Don't worry, it's still drivable. I don't know. It's just been a difficult year. Like, we had somebody break into our car. My wife was tired, I think, and like backed into one of those concrete cylinders in the hospital parking garage. And somehow this car is still driving. So I don't know. I mean, talk about pent up demand in the economy. When we move, man, I am at least going to 1,500 square feet, and I am definitely going for a car that hasn't had a tree fall on it. So I don't know.
It sounds like the Travis I know, right?
I know. So today's episode is talking about, everybody's like, oh my gosh, like, why do I listen to this guy for student loan advice? So we're talking today about how your life goals should come first and your loan should come last. So I'm pretty excited about this, because I think that we're going to make a list of 7 key life goals that are just way more important than your student loans, that should come way before your student loans, before you worry about your student loans. Now, I will say, you can't default, right? You don't want to do that. And the reason you don't want to default, Lauren, is wage garnishment. They can take 15% of your income. Why would 15% of your income be worse than just paying something for student loans? Like, why would default end up costing you more just from a cash flow perspective than just paying what you have to pay with like income-based options?
Yeah, because you could actually be paying 10% of your income if you chose something like repay or pay as you earn, assuming that you're eligible for those two programs. So if you actually are suffering from low income or even no income, an income-based repayment would be much better than, you know, being in repayment, not paying the loans, ruining your credit, going into default, and having to pay 15% toward those loans each month.
Yeah. And how often would you say people come to us and they think they're paying the minimum payment, but they're not actually paying the minimum payment?
Oh, that happens all the time, where they're not quite sure what exactly payment plan they're on, what they should be doing. And they're just doing what they feel like they can afford, not realizing that there is something called income driven, which is set up to be exactly what you can afford.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I think a lot of times people are unaware about community property loopholes, right? Filing taxes separately. They overcommit when they refinance to a 10-year right away instead of a 20-year, mm-hmm. right? So if you want to figure out what is your actual minimum payment, and whatever that minimum payment is, you do have to make it, right? And right now, that minimum payment for most people is still zero until the end of September. So I'm not saying like, let your loans go into default so you can achieve these 7 life goals. That's not what we're saying, right? But I do think that these things come way before making any additional effort on your loans. So we're going to talk about what these 7 life goals are in a second. First, let's talk a little bit about one case study that I had happen a few years ago. So it was a couple chiropractors. Each of them had about $200,000 alone. So each made about $50,000. They came to us with like a very, very strong predisposition towards a anti-debt personality. This person was, both of them would go through this program at their church, and they like had been taught debt is so bad. Debt is like almost anathema to your faith, Like, it was that level of like hatred of debt. And so we told them like, hey, you should probably go for pay or repay kind of thing. And they're like, no, I think we're going to go our own path on this. And so they paid about $40,000 towards their student loans and came back to us with about $380,000, down from $400,000 in debt after a year. And they felt pretty defeated. People don't understand like the interest. So why would someone with $400,000 of loans who's paid half their income on loans come back and only have like a small chunk of their loans paid off? Why did that happen to this couple?
Yeah, so a few things could have happened. They could have been on an income-driven plan previously. They could have been on an extended or graduated plan where they were pretty much only paying interest. And interest accrues in a separate bucket when you're not paying enough toward your loans. So what sometimes it is, people switch gears. They say, oh yeah, I'm ready. Let's do this. And they start throwing everything they can toward the loans. What they don't realize, though, is that they have to first pay down the bucket of interest, empty that out, and then start tapping into their principal. And then when you have a really large loan balance, a lot of interest is accruing on an annual or a monthly basis. So you have this big amount of interest and you're paying just enough to cover the interest. You might not be tapping into the principal. So in their case, they might have been paying down $100 a month toward principal and, you know, just covering the interest because the loans were so big. A lot of the chiropractors I've worked with through Student Loan Planner are, you know, 50, 65K of income. And it, even with their full income going toward it, it's just not enough to make a big dent when you have 400K of debt.
Yeah. So they had sacrificed so much of their lives. Like when they came back for a follow-up consult, it is up to the borrower what path they take. Like you can act against advice, kind of like you go to the doctor and it's like, they make you sign something as like you were acting against medical advice, right? But like that's still your right to do that. Certainly financially, that's like less serious maybe than in the medical world. We'll say like, this is our recommended path. If you're not going to go with it, that's your choice. But we want to make sure that you have it, that this is our recommended path. So they came back to us and they had sacrificed a year of putting off having a family, buying a house, starting their business. Like they had sacrificed everything just to pay their debt. And so they ended up kind of working for free for a year. What are some like just emotions of people that you've talked to that have sacrificed so much to pay their loans and it really hasn't made much of a dent? Like what have been some of those emotions that people have come to you after sacrificing all that and not seeing a lot of results?
Yeah, debt fatigue is very real. Some of the emotions I encounter are, you know, anger, frustration, anxiety, depression. A lot of people, you know, kind of just take the opposite behavioral route. It's like, I did everything right. I was so diligent and I don't feel like I got any payoff. So now I'm going to do everything wrong. I'm going to go get credit card debt. I'm going to buy myself the Ferrari, the fancy car, the fancy house, all the things, and just go a completely 180, you know, opposite direction because I'm so angry at how hard I worked and I didn't see any result.
Yeah, you can only suffer so much before you just give out. Isn't there some sort of like expectation for like POWs that there's like a level where you're just going to give the information because humans can only take like so much suffering? And I think the same thing is true with debt. I don't know if you have any stories, but like some of my stories are like people that do decide, hey, you know what, I'm just going to pay down my debt regardless, specifically people who have debt to income ratios above 2-1, like they owe more than double their income. They do it pretty good for like 1 to 3 years, yeah. Right? And then by like year 2 or 3, your in-law's basement starts feeling like prison and you feel like, I can't take this anymore. Like I'm going to like jump off a bridge or I'm going to go get my own apartment, like one of the two, right?
Yep.
And so I guess it doesn't often end up being sustainable. Like the rice and beans approach can work for like 2 or 3 years, but beyond that, like people sort of give up. Have you seen something different?
No, I've seen the exact same thing where, you know, we kind of map out a plan and say, okay, well, this is how much you can afford. You know, it's going to take you 7 years to do this instead of 10. 7 years is quite a bit of time. And so, like you said, for the first 2 years, it sounds like an awesome thing to do. But 24 months later, you're just like, man, you know, my friends have gone on this vacation. My friends have gotten to do this. And there's a lot of, you know, comparison and FOMO. You feel like you're missing out on something. And you're just like, I can't do this anymore. I want to live. What's the point of going to work just to pay bills and just to pay this one specific bill pretty much? I have to have a life beyond this and I cannot continue on this path.
I guess for the Gen Xers in our audience, FOMO is what? Fear of missing out?
Yes.
Just kidding. But we've got FOMO, we've got YOLO. We've got a lot of acronyms here. So YOLO, you only live once. So there's all this FOMO YOLO economy going on right now.
Right.
So I guess in terms of the seven life goals, because we promise people seven life goals. So we're going to kind of attack this, you know, in a structural way. Otherwise, people will just hear about all of the misfortunes of Travis's cars getting hit by trees, you know, for an hour. So I think I want to try to keep it on track.
Right, right.
One night. Yeah, Laura, you know I can get off track pretty easily, right?
Never fear. I am here to keep you on track. Let's get into that first goal. It is being happy in your career.
Okay, say I'm, you know, got a lot of loans. And say I'm not feeling like I love my job. What are some options that people have so that they can try to be more happy in their job? What can you do?
Well, one of the first things you can consider is these income-driven repayment plans. So a lot of times I see this with lawyers. Burnout for lawyers is very, very real. They go to law school. They take on quite a bit of debt. They clerk for a year just to get in. So they go big law and they're earning a great income. But those billable hours are hours of your life, hours of your time, less hours sleeping. And you're just like, I am exhausted. What can I do that's meaningful? I have this great degree. I have all this knowledge and information, but I want something more meaningful. And they end up going to, you know, some other job, maybe private practice, family practice, something like that, way less income than that big law job. You get on an income-driven plan and you ride that out for 20 or 25 years, depending on when you borrowed. It's affordable. You set aside some money into a tax bomb account, and now you can kind of have your cake and eat it too, in the sense that you have a career that's very rewarding. You get to go home at a normal hour, and your loans are not going to stop you from having that career.
So in other words, if I'm in big law because I feel like I have to make my student loan payment, what you're saying is I don't actually have to go earn that huge salary just to make a loan payment.
That's exactly what I'm saying. There are other options out there. Money is not everything. Like I said, that's what this is all about. The seven things you can do outside of having to prioritize your student loans, and the seven things you should do, you prioritize over your student loans. You can definitely have a life with a lower income that is very meaningful and really, really awesome.
Well, let's talk a little more about that. Let's say that I feel like I've made the wrong field decision. Like I'm just in the entire wrong field. I've got 200 grand in loans and I became a physical therapist, a chiropractor, a lawyer or something. And I feel like I dedicated like 5 years of my life to this, you know, and I can't do anything else because I have all this debt. So there's this thing called sunk cost fallacy where people look at the past and they like overvalue the investment they made. Mm-hmm. And then there's also, a misconception around people being able to go back to school, even with a lot of debt. So I don't know which one you want to tackle first. So that sunk cost fallacy and then people feeling like they can't go back to school. Like, why do those cause issues for people in making the best decisions?
Yeah. So, you know, with sunk cost fallacy, it's kind of like anchoring to, well, I've come this far, I can't turn back now. And the truth is you can become anything, be anything. Like I said, I was a track and field athlete for 3 Olympic Games. And, you know, while it was not a negative experience in my life, you know, I could have thought of myself as only a track and field athlete. Instead, I said, ha, new opportunity ahead. Let me go take this new path and see where it leads. And little did I know, I would become a winter Olympian. I would compete in negative 17 degrees. And, you know, there was a whole new path that was completely opposite of the previous path. And in my case, it was actually less earning. So I had a good earning potential in track and field and way less earning potential in bobsled. It's much more blue collar as a sport. We did a lot of fundraising to be able to afford things. But I had anchored too. I can only do this one thing. I can only stay here. Then I would have missed out on something. And that is the idea of the sunk cost fallacy.
For listeners who like don't know you like I do, you became a financial planner. But before that, how many gold medals did you win?
I have 1 gold and 2 silver medals. I am a 4-time Olympian and the first American woman to earn a medal in both the summer and the winter Olympics.
So we're going to talk more about that with like the entrepreneurship question later, but like, that's pretty amazing that you transitioned from professional athlete, Olympian to financial planning to, you know, you do multiple things. Now you're a financial planner for your own business and you're also a consultant for student loan planner. From a loan perspective though, because a lot of people be like, oh great, I'm not an Olympian. You know, like you hear you say 17 degrees, like, you know, winning medals in negative 17 or practicing negative. I don't want to walk in negative 17 degrees, like, you know, so like in terms of the people having debt already, what's set up about the loan program that allows people to take on like another 200K of debt to change fields? Like, why is that even possible?
Yeah, it's possible because you can borrow in an unlimited capacity to be able to take on your master's degree or whatever graduate program you're going to pursue. But in addition to that, once you get done, you can get on one of these income-driven repayment plans. So it's not all about paying the debt back. Some people are on the side of everybody needs to get their all their loans forgiven. Everybody needs to pay everything back. We talked about, you know, some of that mindset. But in reality, the education system is really what's broken. And until that part gets fixed, we've got to make the most of the plans that are available to us. And the income-driven repayment plans are a really great option for you to be able to take on some additional debt because it's going to be tied to your payment is going to be tied to your income. So if you go on and get a second degree in your 40s, decide you want to go and become a physician, quite a bit of schooling that you got to do, quite a bit of debt that you might take on to be able to become a physician, but all is not lost. You get done, you finish all the prerequisites to be able to become an attending and you're off and running to the races. And then you decide, well, I want to go, you know, abroad and do something like, you know, help people with this medical degree that I've gotten in third world countries. Well, you may not earn a lot doing that. And that debt will be based on your income and you can be actually in a very affordable situation, have the education you need to be able to make a difference in the lives of so many people.
The federal loan program allows you to take out unlimited amounts to cover the cost of attendance, and the Grad Plus program is unlimited. You know, so, you know, if you're unhappy in your field, go back and get another degree. If you are unhappy in your job, I had a dentist one time, Lauren, that was driving 2 hours each way just to go to like a National Health Service Corps eligible job site where he would get, I think, $25,000 of loan forgiveness a year. His wife was driving like an hour in the opposite direction, like they were living in between the two jobs. I looked at their situation. I was like, okay, do you know that you're better off on pay as you earn? And like, you're going for a 20-year forgiveness like anyway. And so like the very most you're getting is a little bit of money towards income-driven repayment. But even then, the way the program worked at the time, like, you know, he was having a hard time matching up that loan repayment to the, you know, it required payments that he had to make. This is what he said. He was like, so you tell me that I'm driving 2 hours like one way every day for like no reason. I'm like, yeah. and there was this silence. You know, if you're at all unhappy in your career, like that's so important. It's so much more important than your loans. It's so much more important than how much you have, what your payment is, because your payment's probably going to be about the same, just 10% of your income regardless. So don't overvalue the loans when you're talking about like being happy in your job. Trust me, I don't know if you've ever felt this, Lauren, but I've been miserable in a job before. And it was so not worth it, the extra money that I got sticking it out a little bit longer. Not a good life plan.
Yeah. Some might be saying that, oh, that's so millennial to think that you should be happy in your work. But it is true. No matter your age, no matter what it is that you're interested in, we all deserve to love what we do. And you do it so much better when you really enjoy it. So to really take some time and think about what it is that excites you. And, you know, it's okay to make a living for those things. So go and make a living doing what you're passionate about. That sounds a little bit cliche, but I know for Travis and I, we can definitely speak to the joy that we feel when we finish a consultation and someone's life has been changed and this work being very incredibly meaningful to us. And I wouldn't do something else. Like what you said, we'll get to that in the entrepreneurial part of why I choose this over something else. But you definitely should be happy in your career because you can make a much better difference when you are.
So number two life goal is why that you should have the relationship that you want or don't want when it comes to long-term partnership or marriage. So like, why would people think that student loans hold back marriage and why does it not?
Well, the first thing is I like the don't part. You know, you don't need to stay stuck in a relationship. So if you married a rich oil baron just so they can help you pay off your student loans and you don't like that person very much, you can go the other direction. but so many people reach out to us and they're paused and they feel like they can't get married because one person is going to be inheriting the other person's student loan debt. They're worried about how this is going to affect the overall family. Will they ever be able to purchase a home when they get married because this debt is going to show up? And there's all these different kind of misnomers and misconceptions, but you can actually get married. If that is a value that is near and dear to your heart, you can choose to do married filing separately. If you live in a community property state, there are some extra benefits if you are, say, the breadwinner. We call it the breadwinner loophole, where you can take some of your income and put it over into your spouse's bucket, income bucket, if you will, and actually get a lower student loan payment. So there's lots of different strategies that you can use once you're married, but student loans don't have to hold you back. And when we're talking federal debt, if you were to pass away, your loans would pass away with you. So your spouse is not going to be on the hook for them. So that's not a reason to hold back from getting married.
So what we're saying is that if you're using your student loans as a reason why you can't commit, you got to fess up. It's because you can't commit. It's not the loans.
It is not the loans. Do what you love with whomever you love, and don't let your student loans get in the way of love.
So number three is what?
Number three is being content with your housing. Ooh, this is a good one.
So what I mean by this is people feel like I can't buy a house because of my student loans. Mm-hmm. So why is it not the case that you just can't buy a house because you have $400,000 of student loans?
Yeah, well, the housing market is crazy right now. And we've been getting a lot of questions around student loans and how to be able to purchase a home. And one of the things that we've come up against quite a bit is that because of the COVID forbearance, people's loans are showing 0% interest and $0 payments. And how most lenders are going to calculate your payment is based on your monthly debt to income ratio. So that's a really important first factor, is that a lot of people think, oh, I have $600,000 of student loan debts, I'll never be able to purchase a home because my debt to income ratio is so high. What matters most is what is your payment on a monthly basis for the majority of lenders. However, if your payment is zero, what they generally do is take 1% of the debt balance. So you need to be really careful and figure out if this lender is only going to use 1% and there's no way that they're going to let me, you know, submit some sort of alternative documentation to show them, then maybe I need to go find another lender. Because there are lenders that are accepting additional documentation that says like, hey, this is what my payment usually would be if COVID forbearance wasn't happening. And then they're getting approved for their mortgage based on that. So just because you have student loan debt, you're not going to be stopped from purchasing a home. I mean, there's a lot of different strategies you need to understand.
So we're like talking to this relocation person with our move. She's a realtor and she has us on this email distribution list. And it's so bad because it like sends emails, like including my wife, when like a status has been changed on the house. And so they'll send out the list and it'll show like for sale. And then the next day, a lot of times it sends her like an update and it's like status update under contract. Oh my gosh. I hear about it like every day. My wife's like, oh no. Oh no. There's another one. Oh, it's gone. Oh my gosh. There's another one. Oh no. You know, and so it's like this feeling like there's no way we could be a homeowner right now. And it's tough too, because you feel like you got to get that mortgage. You got to get pre-qualified. And then you got to put out an offer in like way above asking, because you know, you're going to miss out to a cash offer. So you have to get this really high offer. So the thing is like, because usually the banks will just say, well, what is your income-based payment? Like that's what they usually do in normal times. Mm-hmm. And then they say, okay, we're going to lower what you'd qualify for a mortgage for like a little bit, but you can still get a mortgage. Like a lot of people don't really realize that until they apply on an income-based plan for a mortgage and they get surprised how much they qualify for, right?
Exactly. One thing we haven't talked a whole lot about, you know, I feel like I've been driving home the income drivens today, and that's not appropriate for everyone. Some people do need to refinance their loans and pay them back, but you also need to be strategic about how you pay them back if a home purchase is in your near future. So as an example, you may be able to pay your loans back really aggressively. It may be the most cost efficient thing to do, and you may have the earnings to support that. But if you do a 5-year refinance, you're going to have a really big student loan payment on a monthly basis. And we were just talking about your monthly debt to income ratio. That could really majorly mess up your home purchase potential. So what would make a lot more sense is if you're, you know, brand new, a dentist or a doctor are people that we frequently run into that are, you know, maybe in a residency in a lower amount, a lower earning, and they're going to jump to a higher earning. So you could use repay, end up with a low payment overall, and then refinance your loans once you're into the mortgage. Or if you're ready to refinance right now, maybe do a 20-year with a fixed interest rate. That way you have a lower monthly payment, so that debt to income ratio looks really good. And then once you're done, you use what we call the refinancing ladder to be able to take advantage of paying down the debt more aggressively and, you know, kind of arbitraging the interest rates.
Yeah. And there's some areas where it really doesn't make sense from a math perspective to buy a house ever, like Manhattan, San Francisco. The prices relative to the rents are at a level where it just doesn't make sense to buy a house. So we try to tell people, find a house for like 2 times your household income or less. If you find something that in terms of not just the list price too, right? It's like the price you're actually going to pay, like way over asking. If that price divided by your household income gives you a ratio better than two, then go buy a house if you want to. That's totally fine. And you can obviously go above that, but I definitely think that there's going to be some people left out in the cold when this current phase that we're in of everybody's like house hungry, like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about it to my brother today, who's having a hard time buying a house in Atlanta. What's like the reason for this like housing market just being on fire? It's just like no supply, right? Demand's always been there. It's just right now, it's just supply is not there. And so eventually people are going to be able to travel again and old people are going to feel like it's okay to go to a nursing home again and downsizing again, right? So like eventually those sales are going to start up like they would normally. And then also everybody sees all these super high prices. So all the home builders are going out and building tons of houses right now. And that takes a while to catch up to that demand. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. So I was just saying, if you buy a house right now, great. You can do that. But also don't feel scared. Like if I don't buy right now, I'm going to miss out on a house forever. That's how you get stuck in a really bad situation.
Yeah. And I think it's so important. You know, we call this one, be content with your housing, even though we talked a lot about a home purchase, to reflect on what are your values? What are your goals? What is your vision for yourself and your family? Because sometimes we buy a house just because it's like the next adult thing to do. You know, I've done this, I've secured my job, and so I'm going to purchase a home. If travel is super duper important to you and you're never going to be home to be in that house anyway, then maybe you don't need to take on as much house. Like you said, this pandemic has kind of skewed things where people have been at home a lot more, on top of each other a lot more, and they're just like, I need more space, I need more stability in my life. And so they do that, but as soon as the world opens back up, you're going to be on a plane every other minute like me, because I love to travel, then maybe housing is not the thing that you absolutely need to do. So being content with the housing that's appropriate for you and knowing that this is just a blip in time and this is not what things should look like for the long term for us if you're doing a pandemic purchase.
It's easy to say that, Lauren, but when you've had five people in one bathroom and 1,000 square feet for the past year, right? The trauma of that, that's kind of what's happening, right? Is anybody who's had too small of a place right now during this freaking pandemic is like, you know what? What do you want? Like my firstborn and $1 million? Like done.
Right.
Like I don't know how I might get $1 million, but I'll find it. People are so desperate because of this year, mm-hmm. which has been so different from what every other year in the rest of our lives will probably be like. You know, I mean, this is probably an aberration, thank goodness. So I think that's really sage advice. So what's number four?
Number four, enjoying experiences. So whether that be traveling, dining out, parties, we want to make sure that you are enjoying your experiences.
As a business owner, I really fear recurring expenses. And when I see a one-time expense, I'm not scared at all. Because a lot of times, like I make a bad decision. And a recurring decision is like something that I have to actively stop. You know what I mean? And so there's nothing special about like a one-time expense versus a recurring expense. If it's a big recurring expense, the stress level is just like way higher from stopping that bad decision. Whereas if it's a one-time thing, I recently had a project that we worked on. I spent, you know, four figures on it. It was like a complete failure. And I just lost all that money. Thank goodness that's not a recurring relationship, because I feel like I'm not a very good business person sometimes, Lauren, because I feel like I really don't like conflict and I really don't like making like mean decisions. If somebody's not cutting it, like I really dread those conversations of like, hey, I don't think we can keep you around anymore.
Never going to be fired. This is good news.
Oh, come on. Oh my gosh. Well, I do eventually get to the right decision. I do eventually like have the gumption to say, okay, this is not working out. But I don't know. I feel like people are like that in their own personal finances a lot more than we think, where it's sort of like you've got that big expense and you're like feeling really bad about canceling it because it's awkward or it's, you know, something that you feel like, oh, maybe I'll use it next month. Whereas these like enjoying life experiences things, like, yeah, going to Disney is like 10 grand or going to Europe is like 10 grand. But it's also that one decision, that one expense versus like a mortgage is like $4,000 every month for your forever home versus like a one-time expense, like is something that you can handle a lot better. So I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts about like one-time expenses, like life experiences versus big recurring expenses?
Yeah, I kind of like the reoccurring because I like stability in my finances. I don't like these blips that make things kind of, you know, extraordinary. But I completely see your point about, like you said, a 30-year mortgage at $4,000 and that just being something that hangs over your head. And in that regard, I am very adverse. I don't want to feel kind of strapped down to anything. And so most of my expenses, you know, as I'm kind of thinking through this, are more discretionary expenses that are not reoccurring because I've, you know, gone out of my way to do things like make sure that I don't have a car note. So I don't have 5 years of paying that thing off over and over. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense. But I think one of the big things to do is, like you said, you can enjoy these experiences, but make sure you kind of save up for them. So that $10,000 trip to Disneyland, you don't have to feel bad for because you maybe swipe your credit card and then you pay it in full that month, or, you know, you write a check for it, or I don't know if anybody writes checks anymore, but you can pay for it in full by doing it and not feel bad at all about that one-time expense.
So I'll give you an interesting example. So my wife is really into global health and does a lot of like global health trips, at least she did pre-pandemic. And so one of the things that we talk about all the time because we laugh about it and we're like, man, that was dumb of us, is she went to Rwanda and she had the ability to go up close and see the super rare gorillas in like the rainforest or something. Mm-hmm. And it was only $800. She was like asking me like whether or not she should put that on her credit card because she didn't have any money at all. Cause she, you know, she'd been training in all these big cities and everything. And so I was like, I don't know. I mean, I guess I could give you the money if you want to do it or something, but I think she just decided like, you know, that's just too much money right now. Mm-hmm. We laugh about it now because we're like, man, you know, even when she's just an attending, we're making a lot more money than we ever thought we were going to make. Mm-hmm. And if we could go back in time and tell our 20 something year old selves, oh my gosh, go up close and see those rare gorillas. Mm-hmm. That was such a dumb decision of us to not do that. I think back a lot about that. When I was in my 20s, all the things I could have done that I can't do now, having more responsibilities. Like, so I don't know. I kind of advise a lot of young people this. It's sort of like the consequences of you not going and having that life experience that you want to have are like so much worse if you don't do it than if you like have a little bit of extra credit card debt or a little bit lower savings rate that month or something. You should go do it, because if you're a responsible person, you're already going to have more money than you need. Like if you're at all worried about your finances, mm-hmm. listening to a show like this, you're already self-selected as somebody who is trying to be responsible. So to that person, we would say anything you can think of, life goals, dreams kind of thing with travel experiences, those kind of things, go do those.
That makes a ton of sense. And I'm just thinking about like base jumping, skydiving, swimming with the dolphins, all the fun things that I have on my to-do list. Yeah, I would definitely spend the money in that moment, because I am of the idea that, you know, if you're not living, then you're dying. So, you know, even if I could die from doing these things like base jumping, then you got to live. So, yeah, when we get back to the YOLO, if you will, you literally do only live once. And if you get an opportunity to fly halfway across the world to Rwanda, you know, what's the odds of you coming back there and being able to see those gorillas? Spend the money. It's okay.
Yeah. So let's do number five. So having the family life you want or don't want should be your priority. So in other words, if you don't want kids, that's great. You should spend that money on other things that you want to do. Maybe you want pets, maybe whatever it is, right? Spend that money. If you want kids, loans should not at all hold you back. So in terms of childcare expenses and just the expenses associated with kids, I'm sure you've had a lot of clients, Lauren, that have expressed, you know, anxiety about this, like they can't have kids even though they want them or something. What are some of the words that you've heard from people that are worried about how their loans are preventing them from having kids?
Well, yeah, I just had a conversation recently with somebody who said, you know, my job as a parent is to be a parent even before the child exists. And I don't feel like I'd be a very good parent to be bringing someone into this world knowing that I'm strapped with this debt. And I'm also going to have the expenses related to them, their childcare, their education. And so as a good parent, I'm not going to have kids. It just broke my heart to hear that, you know, as a thought process for someone. But it was really great to get to the end of that consultation, explain to them that they can, you know, in fact, afford to have children and also pay their student loan debt. One of the parts that's really cool on the spreadsheet is there's a part of that asks how many children or when will kids be joining your family? And we kind of throw in a date. So if you wanted to have two kids, maybe you wanted to do it in 2022, 2024. And we kind of talk right then in the moment about the way that they calculate your payment for an income-driven plan is 1.5 times the federal poverty rate based on your family size. And so if your family size goes up, the federal poverty rate number that they're using for that calculation is different, and that's going to actually result in your student loan payment going down. So, you know, I always joke with clients, you know, go ahead and have 10 kids, but be wary that the expenses are going to be more for those kids than what you're going to save on your student loans. However, you are getting a small decrease in your student loan payments by having the children. Ultimately, it's about getting to the numbers and understanding what your monthly income is going to look like and your other expenses in light of children.
To that person that's being responsible and saying, I have to conquer my debt first, right? I would say, okay, by that logic, we also have to defeat climate change. We also have to defeat racism. You know, the economy has to get fixed. We have to lessen inequality. Like, take all of the world's problems. We have to stop gun violence and get gun control or something. I mean, you know, whatever your things that you're worried about, disarm the North Koreans, right? Like, I don't know. You could literally make this list a mile long. At the end of the day, do you want to be optimistic about the future or not? And this is if you want to have kids. Obviously, a lot of people make an intentional, smart choice for themselves not to.
Right.
But if you feel like you want to, I don't know. Like, I'm, you know this, Lauren, but I'm super weird, right? So I'm watching this British Castles thing on Netflix right now. And one of the things I learned was Mary Queen of Scots had like three wills. And I was like, why would you have three wills? And it's because there was like a 20% chance of dying in childbirth or something like that. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, like, and I'm worried about my kids 529 or something like that. Right. I mean, there will always be concerns that you have about why now is not a stable time. There's never been a parent, I think, in history that has brought the kid into the world and felt like, oh, things are super stable right now. Like, it's right. It's the most destabilizing thing you could possibly imagine. I get wanting to wait so you don't have other stressors like adding to things. One like great example of this is like I have this family that we're friends with, and they have four kids. I don't know how they do it, but they just kind of like stopped caring or worrying about everything. They're the most chill people I know. I don't know how they figured it out, but they do. And so you'll figure it out too. And I told this friend, I was like, do y'all know how much money you're going to get with this like child tax credit this year? And they're like, there's a child tax credit this year? Yeah. Like, you guys are going to get like $20,000 because you have four kids under six all at once in monthly payments starting in July. And they're like, whoa, 20 grand. Like, we're going to have so much money. Like, that's not a usual thing. But I guess I think these things have a way of working themselves out. And from a student loans perspective, like you mentioned, like people can pay less when they have a bigger family size, right?
Mm-hmm. For sure. Do not let your student loans stop you from procreating. The world is going to be a better place with your kids in it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, again, you're listening to the show. You're already a self-selected group that cares, that wants to do the right thing. You will be fine.
Yeah.
You won't sleep. I can attest to that as a new dad, but you'll be fine. So number six is taking risks, especially like related to your business or entrepreneurship, side hustling, new skills, things like that. So Lauren, like you could be anything you want to be. You could have a executive job on Wall Street, making great money, great benefits, very stable. Why did you take a chance at starting your own business first before you and I met, and why do you do student loan consults for Student Loan Planner when you could do other things?
Yeah, there's so many things in this world that where there's so many needs in this world is a better way to say it. And there's people that can fill those needs that are not filling those needs because they are living in fear, not willing to jump off that ledge and really make this world a better place. So for me, it was very much, I saw a gap. So you can listen to a previous episode where I kind of talk more about my overall financial situation and what brought me to financial planning. But the short story is I had financial advisors that didn't do a good job for me. And I realized that young professionals didn't have a financial person that they could go to. So most financial professionals are going to tell you need $1 million in assets before you can be a client. Or, you know, they have an annual minimum of $7,000 or $8,000 a year. There's all these kind of barriers to entry. I had a really good living at 20 years old, and I really wanted help with my finances. And I realized that there was no one that could help me in the way that I needed to be helped. So budgeting, first time home purchase, how much to set aside for taxes, all these different things. And now I get to fill a gap, and that's much more rewarding than going to make, you know, six figures, working for someone else, maybe with some golden handcuffs, having established myself and understanding finance the way that I do now, I think I'd be a good asset to some big stable company, but I don't want to work 9 to 5. I don't want to, you know, ask permission to take vacation. And I definitely want to make sure that when I leave this earth, that people realize, oh, she made an impact. She really helped me. And I can help far more people in this way than I can by being at a firm and doing that kind of boring 9 to 5 job.
That's quite eloquent. Our clients are really grateful that you made that decision. I know I'm grateful that you made that decision. I think, like, in terms of the people listening to this, like applying this to their own lives, right? Like you said, don't live in fear. And to quote my 20-something-year-old brother, YOLO, you should take a risk and it might not work out. But realize that with the stability of your graduate-level education, you always have something to come back to as long as your skills haven't completely atrophied to the point where they're absent. Right. So yes, like as a medical professional, you can't be out of the workforce for longer than X amount of years. I know that's the thing my wife talks to me about all the time, where she's like, if I ever stopped doing medicine, I could get away with it about a year. And then I feel like my surgical skills wouldn't be up to par where I'd feel comfortable operating on people, mm-hmm. even though I could get a job. So yeah, that there's some things to consider. But like, if you want to go start your own practice, go do it. The worst thing that can happen is it doesn't work out. And you can define what that looks like, right? If you want to ask your boss for like a weird job situation, you know, my wife in like this latest job negotiation, I kind of encouraged her, which, shocker, right? I give people advice for a living. So it's like, sometimes my wife is like, shut up, Travis. but this was a good suggestion. I was like, well, you want more time to do global health. Yeah, we don't need the money, thank goodness. So can you just ask your new employer, like, can you create more time for me in a way that works for you? And so for them, it was all about kind of aligning her salary with what the revenue she was going to bring in was. And so then we found this new way to structure her contract where she gets off extra time for doing what matters to her. And if she hadn't asked for that, she wouldn't have gotten it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's just so key, like, because with loans, like you've stated a couple times on the show, you can pay based on your income. So if you want to go take that risk with your business, your income-driven payment might be zero for a while. And if you're successful, it'll jump back up. And if you're not successful, you can go back to doing something like you were doing and put food on the table that way. So number six, I think I'm really passionate about. I'm always trying to convince people to go take a risk because I know how positively it's impacted my own life. Like, I was really pretty unhappy in that mine was like a 7 to 6 kind of a job. Right. But, you know, I was pretty unhappy. And then, you know, it took me several years of failure. But now I, at least right now, who knows what the future will hold, but right now I earn more than I did and I have more flexibility than I did. So I think that that's pretty exciting to have that option in life. You want to take us home with number seven?
And last but not least, living in the location that you want. I think this is huge. I have a friend that is living in Bali right now and I am eternally envious because my husband is location dependent. So we've got to pick a place where there is a linear accelerator so that he can cure cancer. And that is very important work. But I am trying to build a life where I can get over to Bali or down to South America for a couple months each year. And we still be building the kind of life that we want that is location independent.
Yeah, I guess us poor medical spouses, right? Like, you know, well, exactly. I get, you know, everybody's like, oh, shut up. You guys have so much income stability and great benefits. And that's true. That's true. But the cool thing is, you know, it's a journey, right? You're going to figure out where you're going as a couple or as an individual over time. And you don't have to have the answer tomorrow. The thing about the housing thing, if you have a house, you're kind of stuck in one specific area. And that might be what you want. You might like that. That might be what you're going for. Great. I mean, I guess try to make the best situation of whatever you're going through. Like, I guess, you know, there's two ways to look at not being able to afford a house in Southern California. One is like, dadgummit, like I can't even afford like a 3-bedroom house here. This sucks. And the other way is like, this is awesome. I'm in such a desirable location that the rents and the prices are so high because like the weather's freaking amazing and I never have to shovel 8 feet of snow out of my driveway. Right. You know, I mean, so there's always this like negative way to look at things and the positive way to look at things. And the good news about student loans is you can live anywhere in the world. Because, you know, if you want to be in California, you can. You'll probably need to do income-driven repayment for a lot more often for people than, you know, if you lived in like a lower cost of living area. If you want to be in New York City, you can do that. If you want to be in Europe or Australia, we have a lot of people, like I have a whole contingent of veterinarian clients that moved to Australia because they met some Australian person. You know, Australian people, they just travel everywhere. I don't know. So there's probably like a 1 in 20 chance that if you're single and you travel, you'll end up with an Australian, I guess. I don't know. But they moved there and they can pay zero for their loan forgiveness program because it's based on U.S. taxable income and they exempt the first 100K that you earn abroad on your U.S. taxes. So they're paying zero a month on their loans. And you can move states. If you don't want to live in one state, you can move to another one. And if it's more expensive to live there, you can pay based on your income and just go for forgiveness. Or if it's a less expensive place, you probably might have an easier path to getting out of debt. I don't know. So I feel your pain, Lauren, about the location independent stuff, about wanting to get over to Bali. That sounds really nice right now, but any travel sounds nice right now, right?
Very much so. And I just think it's so important that, like you said, you align your mindset with what it is that you're trying to accomplish. So focus on the opportunities, not the obstacles. And you can, in fact, live anywhere you want. You can pursue the career that you want. You can have so many things that are on this list and still have that student loan debt and it not hold you back. So I just think it's really, really key that you say, instead of looking at, oh my goodness, I can't do this because, and all the things that are in my way, here's an opportunity. Here's a way to do this. Here's how I can get here. How awesome is it that I live in California, like you said, and this beach is right down the street. You know, it's all about the way that you choose to shape your perspective.
Basically, be your own Prince Harry. You know, because he just, this huge obligation, this massive debt that he owed, the British crown, he got out of it. He figured out a way to manage it. You know, he still kind of, you know, has to deal with it, but, you know, he's able to live where he wants to live. His relationship, he can have whatever he wants for his spouse, right? Being married to Meghan, he can have kids, being happy in his career. So basically, the student debt is like this burdensome obligation that you can get out of. I don't know. I'm terrible with analogies, Lauren. Nope. You know,
you are 100% right. Go be Prince Harry or Princess Harina. I'm going to just change him to a girl name in case you want to flip over to the other side.
Yeah, there's plenty of interesting examples that you can use. But the takeaway from the show, right, is you need to go live whatever your life goals are. Life is too short. You can do it in a responsible way by planning and having an approach to doing so. And so you can also, you know, minimize your payment and have a very specific approach to like achieving those goals, which makes them more likely that you actually accomplish them. And that's what like Lauren and our team is so good at. Lauren, how many hundreds of people have you worked with so far?
I think I'm around 900 now.
900 people, right? Yes. So even if we were bad at giving student loan advice, like we would figure out something after having 900 conversations about people feeling really burdened with their student loan debt. And like, I think that we've figured out how to help people compartmentalize, figure out exactly what it is, figure out how it doesn't affect your life, eliminate the anxiety. We know that student loan payments are going to be starting up again in only a few months. We probably are expecting our calendars are probably going to get overrun. Think about like our calendar, like single family homes, right? There's only so much of our calendar that exists. Right. And when everybody wants one and we can't increase the supply, it might be waiting a while. I'm joking. This is terrible jokes here. But if you need to get a plan, studentloanplanner.com/help. Lauren, what days of the week do you work now?
You can find me on Thursdays and Fridays from 11 to 7 or 7 to 3.
You know, a lot of times people want to work with a specific consultant. We tend to just, you know, have you book and you get who you get. But like Lauren's fantastic. So if you end up working with Lauren, you're going to be lucky. So take care of those life goals and dreams. Don't let student loans get in the way. Until next time, thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner Podcast.